Welcome to the My Family Coach podcast. I'm Claire, and each week you'll find me interviewing a guest expert to find out more about the tricky world of child behaviour, all in handy 15-minute-ish bite-sized chunks. At the end of each episode, we'll send you away with three practical tips. It's perfect for parents, carers, and professionals working with children. And if this episode leaves you wanting more, you can watch, listen and read our wide range of free resources on the My Family Coach website. I'm joined today by Kerry Fleming. Kerry is the head of safeguarding and quality assurance at BEAT, the UK's charity for eating disorders. Kerry is also a registered mental health nurse with over 8 years' experience working with children and adolescents with eating disorders and their carers. And today, Kerry and I are talking about the difficult topic of what if my child shows signs of having an eating disorder. Enjoy the episode. Hi, Kerry, how are you?
Hi, good, thank you. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Really excited to have you on the podcast today. Really excited because this is a topic that we do get asked about quite a bit with parents, carers that we work with. I know I do in particular. And we're talking about eating disorders and how parents, carers and professionals can help a young person to get help. I wondered if you could start off, as we usually do on the podcast, talking about a book you could recommend on the topic.
Of course. So one of my go-to books that has always been a go-to book and a recommended book for me has been the New Maudsley Method book. So it's Skills-Based Caring for a Loved One with an Eating Disorder. And it's by Janet Treasure and Grainne Smith and Anna Crane. And it's easy to spot in the shop or online. It has a beautiful dolphin on the front of it. It's really, really easy to get your hands on. You can get it on Amazon. And the aim of the book is to teach carers the skills of how to kind of manage their loved one, how to look after them, I guess how to navigate through life as much as possible, dealing with what is a really serious mental illness, as we know. And it's really easy read. It is something that carers can sit down and pick chapters from that are more relatable to them. It's a really popular book. We use it as a BEAT for our summer support programs at the moment, and we get some really good feedback from it as well. So it's definitely something I would recommend carers to get their hands on if they are looking for some support.
That's so helpful, isn't it, to have something that's digestible, because I'm sure some of the literature on eating disorders is going to be undigestible and pretty tricky. Tell me a bit more about what skills-based caring is, because it's not really a phrase I think I've come across.
Yeah, of course. So there's a few different ways you can look at it, but particularly thinking about the Maudsley method, is there is a range of skills that carers might need to, I guess, support themselves as well as supporting their loved one. So there's a big aspect in that about looking after themselves. So self-care is a massive aspect for carers because they don't make themselves the first priority anymore. They make their child or whoever they're looking after by far tops that list of priorities. Whereas we know, if we were to give advice to anyone, put yourself first so you don't burn out, so you can give the best care that you possibly can. So the big aspect of learning how to do that and how to continue to allow time for yourself, allow time, whether you're a single carer, making sure that you see friends and you speak to people, or whether you are a couple, making sure you have time for yourselves, protected time for yourselves, and not feeling guilty for doing that, and making sure that you have the support network around you to be able to do that. It also looks at a variety of skills such as communication with your loved one. So it might be how to communicate with them. It might be looking at how your approaches as a carer. So it uses some really fantastic animal analogies, which I won't go into a lot of detail on, but it's really relatable. So you might be like a jellyfish or a rhino and have the qualities of those animals that we all, I guess, resonate with day to day and use day to day. But it can tell you how your communication skills can be hampered by some of those, and how to help you be a dolphin is actually the end goal, hence the dolphin on the front of that book. So it teaches you the skills from communication wise to get to that end goal of being a dolphin, and that it's absolutely fine that maybe every day you are not that dolphin, and that some days you are a bit more of a, we say, like an ostrich with your head in the sand and ignoring it and denying things. I'm completely normal to do that. And it's just that reassurance that what you are doing is the best you can do at that point. So it's teaching you basically how to run through a variety of different skills as a carer that get overlooked and almost assumed we can all do and know. I guess reassures you that they're the right things to be doing.
Amazing, because I think it's overlooked so often. I know sometimes when I'm reading things that are aimed at parents, carers, the focus is on the person with the illness so much, and there's like, oh, here's a random small chapter for parents, carers. Yeah, so what a lovely thing to have such a focus on it, and the metaphors, I love that. So you know immediately what I'm going to do after the podcast is I'm going to be looking it up.
I do, honestly, it's fantastic because even as a professional myself, I have things I do in my own personal life and approaches I take to things. It's easy for me to go, geez, I was being a bit of a terrier there. I was nagging at that person and I shouldn't have been. Again, these will all make sense if you go and read the book. There's loads of nice animals in there. But it just helps you reflect, I guess, and that, do you know what? Yeah, I was a terrier yesterday, but that's okay. I had to be. I had to protect whatever I was protecting. I had to do something. And it just gives you a bit of less isolating, I guess. It makes you feel like other people are going through the exact same thing you're going through. And that is such an important factor for carers, I think.
It is, and that self-reflection and just not giving yourself too much of a hard time about what's going on. I mean, that's got to be really important. Thinking about eating disorders, I know we've talked about the book and we've, you know, sort of recommended it. Tell me a bit about your experience, Kerry, in regards to the topic.
Yeah, so I am a registered mental health nurse by background. So for the last 8 years or so, I have been registered with the NMC, with the majority of my work being done on inpatient eating disorder wards, predominantly with CAMHS, so children and adolescent mental health. So I had a lot of time with carers, distressed carers, worried carers, coming to see the loved ones kind of in really difficult situations or trying to get the loved ones help when they couldn't. And then obviously over the last year or so, I have moved to working within the charity sector. So I now work for BEAT, which is the UK's National Eating Disorder Charity. And that gives me a lot more scope with helping even more people because we have such a broad reach. We are able to support service users and carers really, really well. So all my professional career has been within eating disorders. The love-hate relationship, I guess, with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And not an easy job as well. Working in inpatient facilities, the highs, the lows, and you know, all of those. I think it's important that we define what eating disorders are, because I think probably through the media and different information outlets, there might be some clarity from you around what an eating disorder is.
Yeah, of course. It's something that I guess myself and at BEAT we're really passionate about because there is that stereotypical image that almost supports the stigma around eating disorders, that it's teenage white girls between the ages of 12 and 18 are on the media campaigns, they're everywhere. But realistically, eating disorders, I like to say, don't discriminate. They can affect anyone of any age, any gender, any race. We estimate there's like 1.25 million people in the UK at the moment suffer from eating disorder at
Lot,
any
yeah.
one time. It's a lot of
It's a
people.
lot.
So being able to move away from, oh, it's only this image, this is if you don't look like this or are in this age bracket or from this kind of household class, then it's not an eating disorder. You don't have to worry about it. It affects everyone and it affects everyone so differently. It's a very, very serious mental illness and it can be overlooked at times for picky eating, you know, kind of, oh, attention seeking, all these negative connotations that come with it. And it is so just not the case for what it is. It's not a diet, it's nothing like that. It is a very, very serious mental illness that needs serious treatment, serious support out there.
Absolutely. And I think it's so important that we reference that even on this short podcast, that you know, an eating disorder and what it looks like for one person is going to look different for another. And those that are at risk from, you know, having an eating disorder, it's going to be very different, isn't it? Depending on potentially protective factors that might, you know, protect someone. But just thinking about protective factors, what are some of the things that might protect someone from eating disorders? Because originally, when I was writing my questions down, Kerry, I really wanted to go in and be like, right, why do people get eating disorders? But actually, maybe starting with what are some of the things that help us stay healthy, the protective factors? I'm starting with that.
Yeah, it's a really good one to start with, actually, because people don't talk about that enough. It is very much, or did I cause this? Did we do that? And very much thinking of those things you can't get to the bottom of, you cannot figure out where anything came from. So I think it's really important when you're looking, I guess, with the audience we're looking at today and carers and people looking after someone, how we can ensure that there is enough protective factors around your loved one. So thinking about, I guess, younger people, It would be having that really strong support network around them. So that would be people that they feel comfortable speaking to, feeling safe and having conversations. So if they felt that there was anything maybe not right with themselves, whether that be mentally or physically, that something wasn't okay, they feel they could raise that early on with someone. That can be a really positive protective factor. Having interests, you know, outside of school, outside of uni, having things that they look forward to doing, things that are important, having, I guess, a purpose, another identity is really useful. People with eating disorders sometimes, not again, like you said, not in every case, but they can struggle with knowing who they are without their eating disorder. So having an identity without it is extremely important, whether that be having an interest in something creative or something athletic, something academic, volunteering, anything like that, having something that they can spend time on and enjoy is a really, really good protective factor. Having friends, having a bit of a social life where possible, whether that be, I guess, face to face, or again, some people who may be more inclined to speak to people online, have some kind of social media presence, That's absolutely okay as well. Just having people they can speak to, that they have other things to focus on. They're probably some of the main ones, considering the teenagers. It's also important that, I guess, carers have things they can protect themselves with, And having their support network of adults they can speak to and hopefully relate to as well is key. So for young people, I would say just having other interests to keep them busy is really important.
Yeah, I was struck actually by how much what you're saying relates to some other topics that we've talked about. And what I was getting from the protective factors was actually everything linked back to connection. And that's something that comes up quite a lot in some of the topics that we might talk about. We've talked about early attachments and different things, but that connection as a protective factor is so key, isn't it? That was a theme all the way through the things that you said there.
Yeah, 100%. And you'll see it in your own life and our own lives. As like, I don't have lived experience of an eating disorder. Obviously I've been a professional that's cared for people, but I don't have lived experience myself. But I even know that if I was to go through something traumatic in my life, I know what would get me through that, and they would be my close connections in life, whether that be, I guess, I like to read, it could be something like that, having something as simple as that, but having people in my life, or I guess situations where I can speak to people or reach out to someone, they would be what gets me through those traumatic experiences. So you can relate it to anyone, not just those with an eating disorder. It's just an eating disorder pulls you so far from your loved ones, and it tries to separate you really smartly from your loved ones. It wants you to not have that and not have that support network, that the stronger they are, the better, I guess, outcome possibly for the young person.
Absolutely. And yeah, so important. And it's really nice to see a theme sort of weaving through different episodes. We've thought about some of the protective factors, and I know parents, carers and professionals listening will be really interested to know what some of the signs might be that maybe an eating disorder is occurring. And I suppose, I think for me personally as well, knowing the difference between what an eating disorder is and something that's more disordered eating, and you know, where are the lines?
It's a very gray line. I always wish to myself it was clearer. I think early intervention is key. So spotting early signs, regardless of it being disordered eating or a potential eating disorder, is really, really important. So I'd always ask parents to just be keeping an eye as teenagers get into that kind of maybe puberty type age, and just kind of moving past that. Looking for things at home, like, I guess, very, very things you probably hear every day, saying they've eaten or they will eat later, or that they've eaten more than they have when you know they haven't. Starting maybe some really strict diets, or avoiding foods that they think, or that they're using words, or that's too fattening, I can't use that, I was told that's really bad for you, I can't eat that. Just looking out for keywords like that. Hiding food. Are they giving lots of food to the dog? Are you finding things under placemats, inside of cups, in the bin? Taking a long time to eat meals is a big one. So if you're noticing that your loved one is would have usually eaten the meal with the family in 20 minutes, 25 minutes, but is now kind of picking at their food and it's taking a lot longer. Anxiety around meals, eating out, seeing a change from something that you as a carer know is not your loved one and how they've been. Again, obviously, then there's the physical health signs. You might see weight loss, tiredness, mood swings, stomach pains. And they're kind of just more for the restrictive type eaters. If you might come across a loved one who is binging and you're finding wrappers that are food that you didn't know was eaten, hidden away or kind of stashed in someone's bedroom, different things like that. Spending time in the bathroom after meals or going on extremely long walks after meals or extreme exercising that wasn't there. All those things that have kind of come out of nowhere potentially that might seem like a normal thing to do and can be hidden really, really easily and masked really well. As all my friends are going to the gym, I'm going to go with them. Or I have prom next week, I'm going to go for an extra long walk so my dress fits. Things that might be deemed normal conversation, because society says it's normal. As a carer, you'll know if something isn't right. So look out for signs like that and feel comfortable in approaching your loved one after that.
Yeah, that communication that you mentioned early. So if we've got those open lines of communication, we're connected, we're looking after ourselves, hopefully that opportunity to have an early conversation is there without it being too much of a rub.
Yeah, it's really hard. I think that's one of the hardest things carers find, because they almost feel to blame for some of this stuff, which is completely unnecessary. So they almost struggle with having those first and that initial conversation. So if I was to give any advice to carers for having a talk to a teenager about these kind of concerns, is be very prepared in what you're going to say and be informed about what you're going to say. You know, do some reading, even listen to podcasts like this or going onto Beat's website and getting some further information before you do that would be fantastic. Choosing the time and when you do it is going to be key. Like I would never do it before or after a meal or before or after they've just done maybe what we consider a compensatory behavior, like on for exercise or something like that. That's going to be a stressful time for them. So a completely neutral time. Don't back them into a corner. So instead of saying things like, you need to get help, I've seen things are wrong, just kind of having an open question. I wondered if you'd like to talk about this. I've noticed this yesterday. Allowing them to try and feel safe in speaking to you. They will likely say there's nothing wrong, particularly the first time. If that's the case, just keep an eye and don't be afraid to go back to that conversation again. Don't be afraid to lose your power as that carer. The tables of authority can tip very, very quickly with an eating disorder. And it's important to remember that you are the carer and you know your loved one. Even as a professional, you know them, you're working with them, you have that experience. So don't be afraid to bring that back up again in the same controlled, safe way. And try and feel as confident as you can. Fake it till you make it kind of thing is key sometimes.
It is. Being confident, isn't it, in that you know what's right and that something's different. I really like the phrase that you use, I've noticed, as opposed to you're doing, you know, X, Y, or Z. I've noticed, and I know I've used professionally and in my own life with my loved ones, I'm wondering if is quite a nice one as well, isn't it? Quite genteel. They're great phrases. And I was struck by when you were speaking about the support that parents, carers can offer, but I was also thinking about some of the portrayal in the media that I mentioned before, but also things around social media and how some of those things might impact someone that's already having a difficult time with food. Just some thoughts around that.
It's extremely on topic at the moment, as you can imagine. So you're completely right with the word impact. Social media would never cause an eating disorder, and there's never one single cause, but 100% it can be a perpetuating factor for it. So, for example, if someone has genetic risk and then had a significant life event and then went on a diet for some reason and then social media got involved, that could be the turning point to turning it into a really severe and enduring illness. On social media, we all see it. It's the highlights of your life. There's never any badness. It's all, I've done this, I've done this, I've looked like this, I'm in the gym six times a day, eating, I guess there's what they call What do I eat in a day? TikToks now. There is transformation. TikTok is obviously a big thing at the moment. Beat are working really closely with Instagram and TikTok to try and get filters and kind of warnings in place, and which is really, really good. But we can't, there's ways around everything. So I never would blame it. I use social media myself. I love it. I'm on TikTok. I'm on Instagram. Like, I have nothing against it. I do think that they could be doing a lot more to safeguard our young people. I think from a carer's perspective, from an early age, so even if you've no impression right now that young person, that your loved one is potentially going to develop any mental health illness, have that conversation with the, with them about social media early on. You know, allow them to let you, let them follow them on Instagram, be able to see their pages, see what they're doing. Like, allow that to be a normal form of communication. Be like, oh, actually, I saw this on Instagram today. Like, have those conversations with them. Don't make social media separate to the generation that carers might feel they are. Allow that to be a normal thing, because if it's a normal day-to-day thing for your loved one, you can get involved in that as safely as possible, allowing them their privacy, of course, but don't make them feel like they have to hide things.
Yeah.
If they're coming across things, or they're getting concerned about it, you might be in a conversation up, be like, oh my God, I saw this today. There's loads of these online at the moment. Bring up those conversations with them, and see, get their idea on things, get their opinion on what they feel of these transformation videos. And you can lead that narrative then as the carer, rather than social media leading that narrative. You can start saying, oh my God, this isn't okay. We should be doing, talking about this. We should be encouraging this sort of nutrition, etc. Rather than social media teaching your loved one that, you can take that narrative over quite quickly if you feel confident in doing so.
Well, it, from your response, which I think is absolutely brilliant, it's about laying the foundations early, eating disorder, disordered eating or not, where that foundation of communication is open, particularly centered around body image and social media representation, and what's credible, what's not, what do we believe, you know, critical thinking, you know, setting the foundations early. So those conversations are much easier. And I think we can't really afford not to start laying those foundations early, whether we're talking about eating disorders or other mental health challenges, low self-esteem, you know, whatever it is. Absolutely brilliant tips there. Really made me think about those early foundations of communication. We've just about had 20 minutes, so I'm gonna I know it's gone so quickly. I was like, oh, I had a couple, I had a really clanging question. I'll ask you off air. But if you could just give us your three top tips for parents, carers listening.
Of course. So first one is reach out for help, 100%. There are obviously, our website is fantastic. We go on to beateatingdisorders.org. Everything is there. We even have a new platform called the Pod, Dolphins Pods, all links in some way, shape or form, with where there's chat rooms and forums and modules and e-learning things where you can reach out to other carers as well. You speak to their GP, your loved one's GP, as soon as possible, and they can advise what's in your local area. Remember, you are the carer. As I mentioned earlier on, you know your child better than anyone else. You know who you're looking after better than anyone else. Don't feel pushed out of that role. Feel confident in that as long as you possibly can. And carrying on from that, advocate for your child. We know that there is a tricky time at the moment with waiting lists and getting the right support for people. And if you know what your child needs, or the person you're looking after needs, don't be afraid to stand up for that and advocate for them when they can't, because they're likely not going to want this help early on. Or if they want it, they're uncertain about it and they're scared and they can't ask for what they need. So be that advocate like you would for anything else. If they broke their leg, you would ensure they got the best treatment for that. Advocate as much as possible. Just because it's an area that is not talked about as much does not mean you cannot fight for what you feel they need as well. I think that goes, that gets forgotten about a lot.
Absolutely. And such brilliant tips to help those listening, and also professionals as well that might have queries about individuals that they work with as well. So thank you so much, Kerry, for your time. We're going to put links at the bottom of the episode so people can easily access the great resources that Beat have. And yeah, hopefully I'll catch up with you soon.
Brilliant. Thank you so much, Claire.
You've been listening to the My Family Coach podcast. Thank you for joining us as we lift the lid on the challenging world of child behaviour. Remember to subscribe to listen to all our episodes, and there's heaps more helpful support for all your parenting needs on the My Family Coach website. Thanks again, and I'll see you next time.